The night the Duke of Ashford laughed at her name, Vivienne Marsh was standing on the other side of the wall. She had not meant to be there. The corridor behind the gentleman's dining room at Whitmore's Club was narrow and poorly lit, and she had taken a wrong turn while waiting for her father's solicitor to finish his business at the front desk. She had been perfectly still, her gloved hand resting against the wood paneling when she heard it. First the name, her name, spoken by a voice she did not recognize in a tone that suggested it had been offered as a joke. Then the laughter. It was not the polite, restrained chuckle of a man pretending to be amused. It was genuine, unhurried, the kind of laughter that fills a room and expects no apology. And it belonged, she would later learn, to James Cavendish, the Duke of Ashford, the most sought after, most discussed, most insufferably admired man of the season. She did not move. She did not flush. She did not press her ear to the wall to hear more. She simply listened until the laughter faded, adjusted her gloves, and walked back down the corridor the way she had come. She had already decided something by the time she reached the front door. She was not going to avoid him. She was not going to seek him out either. She was simply going to let him remember this moment for the rest of his life. It had begun, as most unfortunate things did, with good wine and poor judgment. The dinner at Whitmore's had been arranged by Lord Fenwick, who considered himself something of a social architect, and who took great pleasure in gathering men of rank around a table and steering conversation toward what he called asterisk productive territory, which usually meant the business of marriage, inheritance, and who owed whom a favor. There were six of them that evening. James Cavendish sat nearest the fire, as he generally did, not because he demanded the position, but because no one ever thought to take it before he arrived. He was 31, unmarried, and possessed of a fortune so substantial that the topic of his bachelorhood had become less a matter of curiosity and more a matter of civic concern among the mothers of London. He was not unaware of this. He found it on most evenings quietly entertaining. "We ought to settle the question of Ashford," Fenwick said, refilling his glass with the confidence of a man who had already had two. "The season is half over and he has not shown a single preference." "I have shown several preferences," James said, "none of them matrimonial." This produced the expected laughter. "There is the Hartley girl," offered Viscount Pembury, studying his wine. "Considerable dowry, pleasant enough face." "Spoken for," said another man, "quietly but spoken for." "Lady Cecily Drummond," said someone else. James considered this for a moment. Lady Cecily was beautiful in the way that expensive portraits were beautiful, impressive at a distance, oddly cold up close. "She laughs at her own remarks before she finishes making them," he said. "I cannot spend 40 years anticipating the punchline." More laughter. Fenwick leaned back in his chair with the expression of a man holding a card he found particularly amusing. "What about the Marsh girl?" A brief silence. "Marsh," repeated Pembury slowly, as though testing the word for structural integrity. "The solicitor's daughter, from, where is it, Wiltshire?" "Hampshire," Fenwick said. "Father passed last autumn. No brothers, small property, smaller income. She's been staying with a cousin in town for the season." He paused. "I believe she has read a great many books." This, for reasons Vivienne would have found entirely unsurprising, produced the loudest laughter of the evening. James laughed with the rest of them. He could not have told you afterward exactly why. It was the accumulation of details, perhaps, each one more impractical than the last. A solicitor's daughter with no income and a reputation for reading. The very portrait of an unsuitable match, assembled with almost artistic precision. "Marsh," he repeated when the laughter had settled. "Are we fishing in shallow waters now, Fenwick?" "I merely mention her," Fenwick said with a small smile, because she is to be at Countess Whitmore's salon on Thursday. I thought it might amuse you. Everything amuses me, James said pleasantly. That is not the same as interest. The conversation moved on. The wine continued. James forgot the name before the dessert course arrived. He would not forget it again after Thursday. Countess Whitmore's Thursday salons were, by general agreement, the most reliably civilized gatherings of the season. The rooms were warm without being stifling. The conversation was intelligent without being exhausting, and the Countess herself possessed the rare gift of making every guest feel simultaneously welcome and slightly observed, which kept everyone on their best behavior without anyone quite knowing why. James arrived late, which was not unusual, and was received with the particular warmth reserved for men whose presence elevates the perceived importance of an event. He made the necessary rounds. He said the necessary things. He accepted a glass of something pale and stood near the window with Pemberry, who was describing a horse with the kind of emotional investment most men reserved for family members. James was listening with approximately a third of his attention when the doors at the far end of the room opened. He did not look up immediately. Doors opened at these gatherings with some regularity. But the room shifted, not loudly, not dramatically, but in the way rooms do when something enters that was not quite expected. A slight recalibration, a collective, almost imperceptible pause. He looked up. She was not what he had imagined, though he realized in the same instant that he had not imagined anything at all. She had been nothing more than a punchline 2 evenings ago, a collection of unfavorable details arranged for comic effect. He had assigned her no face, no bearing, no presence whatsoever. He assigned her one now, and it cost him something he could not immediately name. Vivienne Marsh was not conventionally striking. She was not the kind of woman who stopped a room by being beautiful in an obvious, uncomplicated way. She was tall for a woman of her era, and she carried herself with a stillness that seemed entirely deliberate, not the stillness of shyness, but of someone who had decided, at some prior point, exactly how much of a room she intended to occupy and was adhering to that decision with quiet discipline. Her dress was simple. Her hair was simply arranged. She wore no jewelry that James could see, save for a single pearl at her throat that looked old and deliberately chosen rather than inherited by accident. None of this was what stopped his laughter, the laughter that had lived, until this moment, comfortably in his memory as an entirely reasonable response to an entirely unremarkable name. What stopped it was her eyes. She was scanning the room with the calm, unhurried thoroughness of someone taking inventory. Not nervously, not hopefully, simply looking, cataloging, and then her gaze reached him, passed across him with the same even attention she had given the wallpaper and the window treatments and moved on. She did not recognize him, or if she did, she gave no indication that the recognition carried any particular weight. James could not recall the last time a woman had looked at him and moved on. Ashford, said Pemberry, I asked whether you thought the left foreleg. Who is that? James said. It was not a question exactly. It came out with insufficient punctuation. Pemberry followed his gaze. Ah, he said, with a tone that suggested he found this development privately satisfying. That is the Marsh girl. The name landed differently than it had on Tuesday. James said nothing. He took a slow sip of his drink and watched as Vivienne was greeted by the Countess with what appeared to be genuine warmth, not the performative warmth extended to guests of rank, but the quieter kind, the kind that implied prior acquaintance and mutual regard. Interesting, the Countess did not offer that warmth carelessly. Vivienne smiled in return. It was a restrained smile, but it reached her eyes, and for one unguarded moment she looked entirely different, younger, warmer, less armored, before the expression settled back into its customary composure. James set down his glass. "Introduce me," he said. Pemberry raised an eyebrow. I thought she was shallow waters. "The depth of water," James said, already moving, "is not always visible from the bank." The introduction was performed by the Countess herself, who managed it with the smooth efficiency of a woman who had arranged a great many meetings and understood that the less ceremony attached to them, the more naturally they proceeded. "Miss Marsh," she said, "may I present the Duke of Ashford? James, this is Miss Vivienne Marsh, who has recently arrived in town and whom I expect you will find considerably more interesting than you anticipate." It was, James thought, a remarkably pointed introduction. The Countess smiled and withdrew before he could examine it further. He turned to Vivienne. She was looking at him with an expression of perfect, courteous neutrality. Not admiration, not nerves, not the carefully managed indifference that women sometimes performed when they were, in fact, quite interested. This was something else entirely, a genuine, unhurried calm that suggested she had taken his measure in approximately 4 seconds and reached a conclusion she was in no rush to share. "Your Grace," she said, her voice was low and even. Hampshire, he thought, educated at home. "Miss Marsh," he said, "I understand you have recently come to town."
"I have."
"And how do you find it?" She considered this with more genuine deliberation than the question probably warranted. "Louder than I expected," she said finally, "and considerably more interested in itself than the rest of the country appears to be." James blinked. It was not rudeness. It was said with perfect pleasantness, as an observation rather than a criticism. But it was unexpected. Most women, when presented with a duke and an opening question, offered something safely appreciative about the parks or the shops or the extraordinary quality of this season's entertainments. "You do not share the enthusiasm," he said. "I share it selectively," she said, "as I do most things." He wanted to ask her what she meant by that. He wanted to ask her several things, in fact, with an urgency that was entirely disproportionate to the length of their acquaintance. Before he could, she glanced past him toward the far side of the room with the air of someone who had just remembered a prior obligation. "If you will excuse me, Your Grace," she said, with a small, courteous nod, "I promised the Countess I would look at something for her in the library." And she left. She did not hurry, she did not look back. James stood where she had left him for a moment longer than was strictly dignified. Pemberry appeared at his elbow. "Well," he said pleasantly, "how were the waters?" James did not answer immediately. He was watching the door through which Vivienne Marsh had just walked, with the distinct and unfamiliar sensation of being a man who had laughed at something he did not yet understand. The library at Countess Whitmore's townhouse was the kind of room that suggested its owner had actually read the books inside it, which, in Vivienne's experience, was rarer than it should have been. The shelves ran floor to ceiling on 3 walls. There were 2 reading chairs positioned with genuine attention to the light, and the desk in the corner bore the comfortable disorder of regular use. Vivienne was not, in truth, there to look at anything for the Countess. She stood at the window overlooking the small rear garden, her hands folded in front of her, and allowed herself 30 seconds to be alone with what had just happened. She had known, the moment the Countess said his name, that it was him. She had recognized the voice before she turned that particular quality of ease, of a man entirely accustomed to rooms arranging themselves around him. She had heard it through a wall 4 days ago, shaped around her name, carrying laughter. She had given him nothing. She was reasonably certain of that. What she had not anticipated was the way he had looked at her, not with the performative interest of a man doing social arithmetic, calculating dowry against bloodline against conversational adequacy. He had looked at her the way she sometimes looked at a passage in a book that said something she had not expected, something that required her to stop and read it again. She did not know what to do with that. She crossed to the desk and opened the second drawer from the top. The Countess had given her the combination of the small lockbox inside it 3 weeks ago, on a rainy afternoon when she had come to tea and stayed for 5 hours and told the older woman everything. Almost everything. The lockbox contained, among other things, a letter. It was written in her father's hand, dated 8 months before his death, and addressed to no one in particular, which was the way her father had sometimes written things he could not bring himself to send. He had called them his asterisk honest letters. He had kept them in a wooden box beneath his desk in Hampshire. Vivienne had found them while sorting his affairs and had read them all in a single night, sitting on the floor in her coat because she had forgotten to light the fire. Most of them were unremarkable, regrets about cases he had handled poorly, apologies to clients he felt he had underserved, one long, tender letter to her mother who had been dead for 12 years. And then this one. She unfolded it now, though she had long since memorized its contents, because there was something steadying about seeing her father's handwriting, the careful, slightly cramped script of a man who had taught himself to write well and never quite lost the effort of it. "I have kept this too long," the letter began, "and I will likely keep it longer because I am a coward in the particular way that careful men are cowards, not from lack of feeling but from excess of consequence. I know what this document means. I know what it would do if it were shown to the right people or the wrong ones, depending on how you look at it." The Cavendish family acquired the Marsh property in Wiltshire in 1809 through a contract that was not valid at the time of signing. Your grandfather was told it was a routine refinancing arrangement. He signed because he trusted the solicitor who presented it, a man in the employ of the then Duke of Ashford, who knew precisely what he was signing and precisely what it meant. Your grandfather lost everything within the year. The estate, the income, the standing. He died believing it was his own failure. It was not. I have the original contract. I have the correspondence between the Cavendish solicitor and the Duke's steward that proves the arrangement was deliberate. I have kept them because I did not know what to do with them, and because the current Duke is not his grandfather, and because I am not certain that justice, at this distance, looks the same as it did at the beginning. I leave this for you to decide. You were always better at deciding than I was. Vivienne refolded the letter along its original creases. The current Duke is not his grandfather. She had thought about that line more than any other. Her father had written it not as an excuse, but as a complication, the kind her father had specialized in, the kind that made simple anger difficult to sustain. She had come to London with the documents. They were not in the lockbox. She was not foolish enough to keep them in someone else's house, but they were close, and she knew exactly what they contained and what they were worth, in both the legal and the human sense of the word. She had not come to ruin James Cavendish. She was not entirely certain what she had come to do. She had told herself it was to see him, to form her own opinion of a man her father had written about with such careful ambivalence, to decide whether the documents should be shown to a solicitor, or burned, or simply kept as her father had kept them, as an honest letter addressed to no one, waiting for a resolution that might never come. She had not expected him to seek her out within 20 minutes of her arrival. She had not expected the way he looked at her. She had not expected to find, beneath the easy confidence and the voice she had heard laughing at her name, something that looked, when he thought she wasn't watching, remarkably like genuine curiosity. She put the letter back in the lockbox and closed the drawer. She was still standing at the desk when she became aware that she was no longer alone in the room. She turned slowly. A woman stood in the doorway, older, impeccably dressed, with the kind of composed, assessing expression that suggested she had spent decades perfecting it. She had James Cavendish's eyes, or rather, he had hers, pale gray, intelligent, and at this moment not particularly warm. Vivienne had never met the Duchess of Ashford. She knew her immediately. "Miss Marsh," the Duchess said, stepping into the room and pulling the door closed behind her. Her voice was pleasant in the way that certain cold days were pleasant, clear and bright, and not at all comfortable. "I thought I might find you in here." Vivienne clasped her hands in front of her and said nothing. She had learned from her father that silence was almost always the more interesting response. "I will not keep you long," the Duchess continued, moving to the center of the room with the unhurried authority of a woman who had never needed to hurry toward anything. "I simply wanted to introduce myself, as my son appears to have taken an interest in doing so himself, and I prefer to know the people who occupy my son's attention before they occupy too much of it." "That seems prudent," Vivienne said. The Duchess's eyes moved over her with careful, thorough attention. "Your father was a solicitor," she said.
"He was."
"In Hampshire?"
"Yes."
A pause. The Duchess's gaze settled on the desk, on the second drawer, which Vivienne had closed but not locked, because locking it would have required the Countess's key, which was currently in Vivienne's coat pocket, and reaching for it would have been a gesture too legible to make. "He passed last autumn," the Duchess said. "I was sorry to hear it." Vivienne looked at her steadily. "Were you acquainted with him?" The question was simple. The Duchess's answer was a fraction of a second too long in coming. "I was not," she said, "but one hears things." It was, Vivienne thought, a remarkably careful answer from a woman who had not struck her as the type to be careful without reason. She held the Duchess's gaze and smiled, the same small, courteous smile she had given James in the salon, the one that offered nothing and asked nothing, and left the other person with the unsettling impression that they had somehow said more than they intended. "How kind," Vivienne said. The Duchess looked at her for a long moment. And then so briefly that Vivienne almost missed it, something moved behind those pale gray eyes. Not hostility, not calculation. Fear. It was gone before it had properly arrived. The Duchess smiled, wished her a pleasant evening, and left the room as composedly as she had entered it. Vivienne stood very still in the silence she left behind. Her father had been right about one thing, she thought. This was considerably more complicated than justice. James Cavendish was not, by nature, a man who pursued. This was not arrogance, precisely. Or rather, it was not asterisk only asterisk arrogance. It was also the accumulated habit of a life in which pursuit had rarely been necessary. Things came to him. Invitations, opportunities, introductions, affections. They arrived with the reliable regularity of the morning post, and he received them with the same pleasant, unhurried attention he gave everything that did not require him to want it too much. He had not wanted anything too much in a very long time. He was aware of this. He was aware of it the way a man is aware of a room that has been closed for years, not with grief exactly, but with a dull, occasional recognition that something inside it had probably gone stale. After Thursday, he found himself thinking about Vivienne Marsh with a frequency that was, by any reasonable measure, disproportionate to the length of their acquaintance. He thought about the way she had looked at him, or rather, the way she had looked asterisk past asterisk him, with that even, unhurried gaze that had assigned him precisely the same weight as the wallpaper. He thought about the particular quality of her stillness, the way she occupied a room without appearing to negotiate with it. He thought about what she had said, "I share it selectively, as I do most things," and the dozens of possible meanings that sentence continued to generate, none of which he could dismiss. He thought with somewhat less comfort about the fact that she had left. Not dramatically,
not with the calculated timing of a woman who understood the value of an exit. She had simply gone, as though the conversation had reached its natural conclusion, and she saw no reason to extend it artificially on his account. He was not accustomed to natural conclusions. By the following Monday, he had found three separate reasons to mention her name in conversation, none of them, he told himself, intentional. By Wednesday, he had stopped telling himself that. The opportunity arrived on Thursday evening, at a card party hosted by Lord and Lady Ashbourne in their Mayfair townhouse. It was the kind of gathering James usually found tolerable at best. The rooms were too warm, the card play was too serious, and Lady Ashbourne had a habit of seating people according to a social logic that satisfied only herself. But Pembury had mentioned, with studied casualness, that the Countess Whitmore would be attending and would likely bring her young Hampshire friend, and James had found his prior engagement suddenly less compelling than he had thought. He arrived to find the drawing room already comfortably full. He made his rounds with the efficiency of long practice, said the right things to the right people, and located Vivienne Marsh within 4 minutes of entering, which was, he noted privately, rather faster than the task should have taken in a room of this size. She was standing near the far window with a woman he did not recognize, apparently deep in conversation about something that was making her companion laugh. Vivienne herself was not laughing. She wore instead that expression he was beginning to recognize, a kind of animated attentiveness, the look of someone genuinely interested in what they were hearing rather than performing interest for social purposes. It was, he thought, a remarkably uncommon expression at a card party in Mayfair. He crossed the room. She saw him coming. He was certain of that, because her gaze moved to him briefly and then returned to her companion without interruption, which meant she had registered his approach and elected to finish her conversation anyway. He waited. It was not a comfortable wait. He was fairly certain it was meant not to be. When her companion excused herself, Vivienne turned to him with the unhurried composure of someone who had not been waiting to do so. "Your Grace," she said. "Miss Marsh." He offered his most disarming smile, the one that had, on various occasions, produced results ranging from forgiveness to mild infatuation. "You appear surprised to see me." "I am not surprised," she said. "Lady Ashbourne's gatherings tend to draw a consistent set. I had rather expected you might be here." "And yet you did not come to say so." "I was in conversation," she said pleasantly, "as were you, I believe, for the first quarter hour." He had been. He was mildly unsettled that she had noticed. "Will you take a turn about the room?" he asked. "Or is that also subject to your selective sharing policy?" Something shifted in her expression, not quite a smile, but the precursor to one, the small internal movement that preceded it. "I will take a turn about the room," she said, "though I should warn you that I am not especially skilled at the kind of conversation these turns usually involve." "What kind is that?" "The kind where both parties say a great deal and communicate very little," she said, falling into step beside him. "I find it exhausting. I prefer to either say something or say nothing."
"Then say something," he said.
She glanced at him sideways. "You first." He laughed genuinely, without calculation, which surprised him. "Very well. I have been thinking about what you said at the Countess's salon, about London being more interested in itself than the rest of the country appears to be. I hope I did not offend." "You did not. You interested me." He paused. "Which is, I will confess, a less common occurrence than one might expect." She was quiet for a moment, and he had the sense that she was deciding something, not about what to say, but about how much of what she actually thought to allow into the open. "I grew up in a house full of books and very little money," she said finally. "My father was a thoughtful man, but not a prosperous one. We did not come to London for the season.
We did not come to London at all, generally. I read about it instead. She paused. Reading about a place and then arriving in it is an interesting experience. You see both versions at once.
And which version do you prefer?
The one in the books was quieter, she said, but this one has better light.
He looked at her. She was watching the room ahead of them with that same level attention, and he had the distinct impression that the remark had been more personal than it sounded, though he could not have said precisely why.
You miss Hampshire, he said. She considered this. I miss my father, she said. Hampshire is simply where he was.
It was said without self-pity, without the slight tremor that people sometimes introduced into sentences about loss in order to signal that sympathy was welcome. It was simply a fact, offered cleanly, and it landed with more weight than a more elaborately expressed grief would have.
James was quiet for a moment.
I lost my father when I was 19, he said. He had not planned to say it. It arrived, as honest things sometimes did, slightly ahead of his permission. I have found in the years since that the missing of him tends to attach itself to objects and places rather than to grief in the abstract. A particular chair. A particular view from a particular window.
Vivienne turned to look at him then, fully, for the first time in the conversation, with the same undivided attention she had given her earlier companion. It lasted only a moment, but it was the kind of moment that had some weight to it, the kind that altered slightly the temperature of what came after.
Yes, she said quietly, that is exactly it.
They walked in silence for a few steps, which ought to have been awkward and was not. Over the following 2 weeks, James found reasons, some legitimate, some constructed with decreasing subtlety, to be where Vivienne Marsh was. At Lady Fenwick's musical evening, he sat 3 chairs to her left and spent more time watching her listen to the performance than listening to it himself. She was entirely still during the music, her hands folded in her lap, her expression composed but inward, as though the notes were being processed somewhere private and personal rather than merely heard. At the Ashbourne Garden party, he steered 2 separate conversations in her direction, and both times found himself staying longer than he had intended, drawn in by the quality of her attention. The way she listened with her whole face, the way she asked questions that were genuinely curious rather than socially obligatory, the way she sometimes paused before answering, as though she found it important to mean what she said. At Lord Pembury's dinner, he was seated 4 places from her, and spent the entirety of the fish course trying to hear what she was saying to the man on her left, which told him something about his current state of mind that he found simultaneously undeniable and inconvenient. She was not warming to him. That was the thing. She was not cooling toward him either. She was consistently pleasant, consistently engaged when they spoke, consistently willing to be honest in a way that most people were not. But she maintained a distance that was not geographical. It was something more internal, a reserve that he could not quite locate the edges of, that felt less like shyness and more like decision. She had decided something about him. He did not know what. He found this, against all prior experience, entirely compelling. It was at the Whitmore Salon, 3 weeks after their first meeting, that the first crack appeared. They had been talking for nearly an hour, standing near the bookshelf at the back of the room with the unspoken mutual agreement of 2 people who had identified the quietest corner of a crowded space and were disinclined to leave it. The conversation had moved, in the organic, unpredictable way of conversations between people genuinely interested in each other, from Hampshire to his estate in Derbyshire, from books to architecture, from architecture to the particular quality of light in old houses that made them feel inhabited by their own histories.
There is a long gallery at Ashford Park, he said, that runs the full length of the east wing. On winter afternoons, the light comes in at an angle that makes everything in it look like it belongs to a different century. He paused.
I have always thought it was the most honest room in the house.
Honest, she repeated.
Undecorated, he said. Or rather, decorated only by what the light does. Everything looks exactly as old as it is. She was quiet for a moment. There was something in her expression, something that moved through it quickly, like a shadow across still water, that he could not read.
I think I would like to see it, she said. And then, as though the admission had surprised her, she looked away.
It was the first time she had offered him anything unguarded. He recognized it as such and did not press it, which cost him something, but which felt, instinctively, certainly, like the right thing to do. Instead he said, "Then you shall." She looked back at him. The unguarded thing was gone, replaced by her customary composure, but her eyes were different, slightly warmer, slightly less resolved.
"You are very certain of things," she said.
"I am learning," he said, "to be certain of fewer of them." She held his gaze for a moment longer than she had before. And then, from across the room, someone called his name, a business associate with the unfortunate timing of the chronically oblivious, and the moment folded closed like a letter being put away. But it had existed, he was sure of that. He was walking back to his carriage an hour later, his mind comfortably full of the evening, when he noticed his mother's personal maid waiting near the side entrance of the Whitmore house. He stopped. His mother had not attended this evening. He had seen her name absent from the guest list and thought nothing of it. She had been unwell the previous week and had declined several invitations. But her maid, standing at the servant's entrance of a house she had no business being at an hour when the salon was still in full progress. He looked at the maid. She looked back at him with the expression of someone who wished very much to be somewhere else.
"When did she arrive?" he asked.
"An hour ago, Your Grace."
"And when did she leave?"
20 minutes passed. He stood very still on the pavement for a moment, the night air cool against his face, working out the timing with the practiced efficiency of a man who had grown up in a household where things were frequently not said aloud.
20 minutes passed,
which was, he calculated it, approximately when Vivienne had excused herself briefly from their conversation to speak with the Countess. He looked back at the house, then at the maid.
"Thank you," he said, in a tone that indicated the conversation was over, and walked to his carriage.
He sat inside it for a long moment before signaling the driver to move. His mother, who had not been invited, who had been unwell, who had no reason to attend a salon she had not been asked to, had sent her personal maid to Countess Whitmore's house on the one evening when Vivienne Marsh was there. He did not know what that meant. He knew, with the cold certainty of a man who had learned early to recognize the shape of things his mother preferred to manage quietly, that he was going to find out. The Duchess of Ashford received guests in the blue sitting room on the second floor of Cavendish House, not the formal reception rooms on the ground floor, which were reserved for occasions requiring the full weight of the family's consequence, but the smaller, more personal room that looked out over the rear garden and was furnished in the particular way of spaces that have been arranged once long ago by someone with very clear preferences and never significantly altered since. It was, Vivienne thought, as she was shown in by a footman whose face communicated absolutely nothing, a room designed to make its occupant appear comfortable and its visitors appear slightly less so. She had received the Duchess's note that morning. It had been delivered to her cousin's house before 9 o'clock, which meant it had been written and dispatched before most of London had finished breakfast. The note itself was brief, gracious, and entirely without warmth, an invitation to take tea that was phrased with sufficient delicacy to be technically deniable as a summons, while making it quite clear that a refusal would be noted and remembered. Vivienne had read it twice, set it down on the breakfast table, finished her toast, and then written back to accept. She had spent the walk to Cavendish House. She had declined her cousin's offer of the carriage, wanting the air and the time to think, deciding what she was and was not willing to give away. The answer, by the time she arrived, was very little, but she intended to pay close attention to everything. The Duchess was already seated when Vivienne entered, which was itself a small, precise communication. A hostess who rises to greet a guest acknowledges that guest standing. A hostess who remains seated acknowledges only her own. Vivienne had expected it. She crossed the room without hesitation and took the chair opposite, settling into it with the unhurried composure her father had always called her greatest social asset and her most reliable defense. "Miss Marsh," the Duchess said, with a smile that was perfectly calibrated, warm enough to be technically welcoming, cool enough to establish that warmth was a thing being offered rather than felt. "How kind of you to come." "How kind of you to invite me," Vivienne said, in precisely the same register. Tea was poured. The Duchess performed this ritual with the automatic grace of a woman who had done it 10,000 times and found in its familiarity a form of authority, the quiet authority of a person entirely at home while their guest was not. Vivienne accepted her cup and waited. She had also learned from her father that in conversations where the other party had requested the meeting, the other party should be allowed to arrive at their purpose in their own time. Rushing them invariably produced caution. Patience, more often than not, produced honesty, or at least a more legible version of dishonesty, which was nearly as useful. The Duchess asked about her cousin. Vivienne answered. The Duchess asked about Hampshire. Vivienne answered that too, briefly and without elaboration. The Duchess observed that the season had been particularly fine this year, that the weather had cooperated to an unusual degree, that the Whitmore salons were always such pleasant evenings. At the mention of the Whitmore salons, something shifted almost imperceptibly in the air between them. "I understand you have become quite a fixture there," the Duchess said, setting down her cup with a small, precise click. "The Countess speaks very warmly of you." "She has been very kind to me," Vivienne said. "I knew her slightly through my father. He handled some correspondence for a friend of hers some years ago." "Yes," the Duchess said. "Your father." A pause. The word sat between them, doing more work than it appeared to. "He was a solicitor for many years, I believe." "He was." "In Hampshire?" "Yes." The Duchess smiled. "A respectable profession, though I imagine a solicitor's practice in the country is quite different from the kind one finds in London." "Considerably quieter," Vivienne agreed, "though my father always said that the quieter cases were often the more interesting ones, the ones with the most history attached to them." She said it without emphasis, without the slightest alteration in her tone. She watched the Duchess receive it. Something moved behind those pale gray eyes, the same thing she had seen at the Whitmore Salon 3 weeks ago, identified then as fear and now, seeing it again, confirmed as such. It was brief and it was controlled, and the Duchess was, by any measure, extraordinarily good at controlling it. But it was there. "How philosophical," the Duchess said pleasantly. "He was a philosophical man," Vivienne said. "I miss that about him particularly." A silence settled. The Duchess lifted her cup again, sipped, and then set it down with the decisive air of someone who had decided to abandon the approach she had been using and try a different one. "Miss Marsh," she said, "I will speak plainly if I may. I find plain speaking saves a great deal of time." "I prefer it," Vivienne said and meant it. "My son has shown a marked interest in your company over the past several weeks." The Duchess folded her hands in her lap. "James is not careless, generally, in the attention he pays to people. When he is interested in something, he tends to pursue it with some determination. I have observed this quality in him since he was a boy." She paused. It is an admirable quality in many contexts.
But not all, Vivian said.
Context matters enormously, the Duchess agreed. As I am sure you understand. Another pause, this one slightly longer, freighted with something that was almost entirely not said.
I do not doubt that you are an intelligent and accomplished young woman, Miss Marsh. The Countess's regard is not given carelessly, and I respect her judgment. But intelligence and accomplishment, however genuine, do not alter certain practical realities.
My son has a name, a title, and responsibilities to his family, and his estate that must be considered alongside his personal inclinations.
Vivian looked at her steadily. You are telling me, she said with perfect pleasantness, that I am unsuitable.
The Duchess did not flinch.
I am telling you, she said, that some attachments, however sincerely formed, create complications that neither party fully anticipates at the outset. She held Vivian's gaze, particularly when one party has unresolved connections to the other's family history.
There it was.
Not direct, not explicit, but unmistakable to anyone who was listening carefully, and Vivian had been listening carefully since she walked into the room.
The Duchess knew about the documents, or knew that there were documents, or suspected, which was perhaps worse, because suspicion, unlike knowledge, could not be addressed or refuted or put to rest. Suspicion simply lived, feeding quietly on everything it could not see.
Vivian set her cup down very carefully on its saucer.
She thought about the letter in her father's careful hand. The current Duke is not his grandfather. She thought about James in the long gallery he had described, the honest room with its winter light. She thought about the way he had said asterisk, I am learning to be certain of fewer things, and the quality of honesty she had heard in it, not performed, not calculated, simply offered.
She thought about the fear in his mother's eyes.
She had several options available to her in this moment. She could deny knowledge of any documents, which would be a lie and would likely not be believed. She could acknowledge them and name them directly, which would be a kind of declaration of war that she had not come here to make. She could say nothing, which would be its own kind of communication. Or she could do what her father had sometimes done in the difficult cases, when the truth was too complicated to be served by any single direct statement. She could say something true that left the other person with more questions than they had arrived with.
My father, Vivian said quietly, was a very careful man. He kept meticulous records. He believed that the past deserved to be documented accurately, not because the past could be changed, but because accuracy was a form of respect.
She paused.
He also believed that documents, like all things, are only as powerful as the use one intends to make of them.
The Duchess was very still.
I have not come to London, Vivian continued in the same measured, even tone, with any intention of making trouble for anyone. That was not my father's wish, and it is not mine.
She met the Duchess's gaze directly.
I came because I needed to see something for myself. I believe I am beginning to.
A long silence.
The Duchess looked at her with an expression that had changed, subtly but perceptibly, over the course of the last 30 seconds. The composure was still there. The composure was, Vivian suspected, structural, built into the woman at a level that went too deep to be touched by a single conversation. But something beneath it had shifted. A recalibration of some kind, too internal to be named precisely.
You are, the Duchess said at last, rather more than I expected.
So I am told, Vivian said, occasionally.
The Duchess looked at her for another long moment. Then she did something that Vivian had not anticipated.
She laughed.
It was brief, and it was genuine, and it transformed her face entirely for the 3 seconds it lasted.
Took 20 years off her age, and replaced the careful, architectural composure with something that looked remarkably like the woman she might have been before she became the woman she was.
Your father, the Duchess said when it had passed, must have been a remarkable man.
He was, Vivienne said. I am sorry you never met him.
The Duchess looked at her sharply, and Vivienne held her gaze, steady and unblinking, letting the sentence sit between them with all of its possible meanings intact. After a moment, the Duchess looked away. They finished their tea in a silence that was, if not warm, at least honest, which was, Vivienne thought, considerably more than she had walked in expecting. She was descending the front steps of Cavendish House when she heard footsteps behind her. She turned. James was coming down the steps two at a time, his coat half on, clearly having seen her from a window and come down in some haste. He stopped when he reached her, slightly out of breath in a way that was entirely undignified and, she thought, entirely genuine. "You were here," he said. It was not quite an accusation. It was not quite a question.
"Your mother invited me to tea," Vivienne said. "I accepted."
He looked at her for a moment with an expression she could not entirely read, something between alarm and something else, something more complicated.
"Are you, did she?" he stopped, apparently reconsidering whatever he had been about to ask.
"She was very gracious," Vivienne said, which was true in the narrowest possible sense. He looked at her steadily. He was doing the thing she had noticed he did when he suspected he was not getting the full picture, a slight stillness, a quality of attention that was more concentrated than his usual easy manner. It was, she had come to think, the most honest version of him, the version that was actually trying rather than simply succeeding.
"Vivienne," he said.
It was the first time he had used her given name. He appeared to realize this at the same moment she did. She saw it register, saw the brief, uncertain pause that followed, and saw him decide after that pause not to apologize for it. She did not ask him to.
"I am quite all right," she said quietly. "There is nothing to worry about."
She held his gaze for a moment longer than was strictly necessary, long enough to let him see that she meant it. And then she put on her gloves with the composed efficiency of a woman who has concluded a visit and is ready to walk home.
"Good afternoon, Your Grace," she said.
She turned and walked down the remaining steps and along the pavement, and she did not look back, and she was two full streets away before she allowed herself to acknowledge, privately and without particular comfort, that the conversation with the Duchess had not frightened her. What frightened her was the way James had said her name, and the fact that she had wanted very much to stay. James did not go back inside immediately. He stood on the front steps of Cavendish House and watched Vivienne walk away, that particular walk of hers, unhurried and straight-backed, the walk of a woman who knew exactly where she was going even when she did not, until she turned the corner and was gone. Then he stood there a moment longer, his coat still half on, the morning air cool against his face, and thought about the fact that his mother had invited Vivienne Marsh to tea without telling him. He thought about what that meant. Then he went back inside. His mother was still in the blue sitting room, the tea things not yet cleared, a small book open in her lap in the way of someone who has picked up a book not to read it, but to have something to look at. She glanced up when he entered and closed the book with the composed unhurriedness of a woman who had been expecting him and saw no reason to appear otherwise.
"James," she said.
"Why did you invite her here?" he said. He kept his voice level. He had learned in 31 years that leveling his voice when speaking to his mother produced better results than the alternative. She responded to composure. She closed against pressure.
"I invited her to tea," his mother said, "because I wish to meet her. You have been in her company at no fewer than 7 separate occasions over the past 3 weeks, which is, by any reasonable measure, a significant allocation of your attention. I thought it prudent to form my own opinion."
"And what is your opinion?" His mother considered this with the deliberateness she brought to most things. "She is considerably more than I expected," she said, which was, James thought, the closest thing to an unqualified compliment his mother had ever paid a woman under 40 who was not related to her by blood. "That is not an answer," he said. "It is the only answer I have at present," she said. "She is not easy to read. I found that both admirable and unsettling, which is, I suppose, a not uncommon response to people of genuine substance." She paused. She spoke of her father. Something in James's chest shifted slightly. "She does that," he said, "simply, without performing it." His mother looked at him with an expression he could not immediately categorize, something between assessment and something more personal. "You are more serious about this than I realized," she said. "Yes," he said. There was no point in qualifying it. A silence settled between them. His mother looked down at the book in her lap, then back up at him, and he saw something working behind her eyes, the particular internal negotiation of a woman deciding how much of what she knew to allow into the open. "Mother," he said quietly, "what did you say to her?"
"I said nothing improper."
"That is not what I asked." Another silence, longer this time. "I suggested," his mother said carefully, "that certain attachments create complications, that practical realities must be considered alongside personal inclinations." She paused. "I may have implied that her family's history with ours was a relevant consideration." James went very still. He heard the words. He turned them over, examining them the way he might examine a document for what it did not say as much as what it did. "Her family's history with ours," said by his mother with that careful, architectural precision she reserved for things she had thought about at length and decided to approach obliquely. Said by a woman who had, 3 weeks ago, sent her personal maid to a salon she had not been invited to, on the evening when Vivienne Marsh was there.
"What history?" he said. It was not a question. He had learned that, too, that questions gave the other party the option of reframing. A statement, delivered with sufficient certainty, was harder to redirect. His mother looked at him for a long moment. He saw her calculate, saw her weigh what he might already know against what she preferred he didn't, saw her arrive at a conclusion she was not happy with.
"James," she said, "there are things about this family's past that were managed long before you took the title, decisions that were made by your grandfather in a different time under different pressures that..."
"What history?" he said again.
She closed her eyes briefly. When she opened them, the composure was still there, but it had acquired, around its edges, the quality of something being held rather than something that simply existed. "The Marsh family," she said, "had an estate in Wiltshire, in 1809. Your grandfather acquired it through a contract that was not straightforward." She said the last two words with the careful understatement of a woman who had spent decades living with what they concealed. Vivienne's grandfather signed documents he was told were a routine refinancing arrangement. They were not. James said nothing. He felt the words arrive and settle, each one adding its weight to something that was assembling itself in his chest with slow, cold precision. "The solicitor involved," his mother continued in the same quiet, careful voice, "was employed by your grandfather's steward. The arrangement was deliberate. The Marsh family lost everything within the year." She paused. "Vivienne's grandfather died believing it was his own failure." The room was very quiet. James looked at his mother, at this woman he had known his entire life, who had managed this house and this family with extraordinary capability and considerable love, who had kept this thing, whatever it was, folded inside her for how long? How long had she known?
"How long?" he said.
She understood him immediately. "Since I married your father," she said. "He told me before the wedding. He said I should know what I was marrying into." A pause. "He was not proud of it. It was his father's doing, not his. But he also did not undo it."
"Because he could not," James said, "or because he chose not to." His mother said nothing, which was, he thought, an answer. He crossed to the window and stood looking out over the rear garden, the old roses along the south wall, the gravel path his father had paced every morning with a cup of coffee, the stone bench where James himself had sat as a boy doing lessons in the summer, not knowing any of it.
"Vivienne has documents," he said. "It was not a question."
"I believe so," his mother said. "Her father was a solicitor. He would have kept records." She paused. "I do not know what she intends to do with them."
"I do," James said.
His mother looked at him.
"She intends to do nothing with them," he said.
"That is what she told you, isn't it? In some form, she came here to understand something, not to make a claim."
"She said," his mother said slowly, "that documents are only as powerful as the use one intends to make of them."
A pause, and that she had not come to London to make trouble.
James turned from the window. He thought about Vivienne in the Whitmore library, the second drawer of the Countess's desk. He had not understood the significance of that at the time, had filed it away as a minor detail without context. He understood it now. He thought about the quality of reserve she carried, the distance that was not shyness but decision, the decision of a woman who knew something considerable and had chosen, for reasons of her own, not to use it. He thought about what that kind of restraint cost a person. He thought about her father's letters, the honest ones addressed to no one, and the weight of a legacy like that, not wealth, not property, but a truth too complicated to resolve, passed from one careful person to another. He thought about the laughter at Whitmore's club, his own laughter, unhurried and easy and entirely ignorant, and felt something about it that was worse, considerably worse than embarrassment.
"I need to see the family records," he said.
"James."
The correspondence from grandfather's steward, the 1809 Wiltshire contracts, whatever is in the archive. He turned to face her. "I need to see all of it." His mother looked at him for a long, still moment. Then something in her expression changed, not collapsed, not surrendered, but released, in the way of something that has been held at tension for a very long time and has finally been allowed to lower.
"The archive is in the east wing," she said quietly. "Third cabinet from the left. The key is with Hendricks."
James looked at her. "You knew where it was."
"I have always known where it was," she said. She held his gaze steadily, and he saw in her eyes something he had not expected to find there. Not guilt exactly, but a long accumulated weariness, the look of a woman who had carried a thing for decades and had perhaps, somewhere very private, been waiting for someone to take it from her.
"I simply did not know what to do about it."
He nodded once.
He left the room without another word and went to find Hendricks. The archive was cold and smelled of paper and old leather, and the particular damp that accumulated in rooms that were maintained but not lived in. The third cabinet from the left contained four drawers. James started with the bottom one, which held the oldest materials, and worked upward. He found the Wiltshire correspondence in the second drawer. It was filed under a heading that described itself, blandly and entirely without shame, as asterisk property acquisitions 1805-1815, among a dozen other folders containing the ordinary business of an estate that had operated at the scale of a small institution. He almost missed it. It was labeled asterisk Marsh, Wiltshire, 1809 in the neat, careful hand of his grandfather's secretary, a man who had apparently kept meticulous records of everything, including the things that should perhaps not have been so carefully preserved. He read it in the archive, standing at the cabinet with the folder open in his hands, in the gray afternoon light that came through the single small window near the ceiling. It took him 40 minutes to read everything. Some of it was dry and procedural contract language, conveyancing terms, the ordinary administrative machinery of a property transfer.
but the correspondence between his grandfather's steward and the solicitor employed to handle the Marsh side of the transaction was not dry. It was specific and deliberate and left very little room for alternative interpretation. The Marsh family had been deceived, systematically, with forethought. Vivienne's grandfather had died believing he had failed his family. He had not failed anything. James closed the folder and stood for a moment in the cold, paper-smelling room with his eyes shut, doing nothing in particular except allowing the full weight of it to arrive. Then he put the folder back in the cabinet, closed the drawer, and went to get his coat. He was at Vivienne's cousin's house within the hour. The cousin, a pleasant, slightly flustered woman named Mrs. Hartley, who clearly had no idea what to make of a duke arriving unannounced at her door at 4:30, told him, with profuse apology, that Miss Marsh was not at home. "When do you expect her?" James asked. Mrs. Hartley appeared to be doing rapid social calculations. "She went out this afternoon, Your Grace. After she returned from that is, I'm not entirely certain when she'll." "I will wait," James said. Mrs. Hartley blinked. "I beg your pardon." "If you'll permit it," he said, "I will wait." She permitted it, in the manner of a woman who had not technically been given the option of declining, and showed him into a small sitting room that smelled of cut flowers and recent cleaning. He sat in a chair by the window. He did not pace. He looked out at the street and thought about what he was going to say. He was still thinking about it when he heard the front door and Vivienne's voice in the hall, and then a brief, murmured exchange between her and Mrs. Hartley that he could not make out. A pause, then footsteps on the floor not hurried, which he found simultaneously frustrating and admirable. She appeared in the doorway. She had clearly been walking. Her cheeks were slightly flushed from the air, and there was a fine mist of dampness on her coat. It had begun to rain somewhere in the last hour, and she was looking at him with an expression that was not quite surprised, which suggested Mrs. Hartley had warned her, but which contained something beneath its composure that he could not name. "Your Grace," she said. He stood, Vivienne. He had decided, some time in the last hour, that he was not going back to Miss Marsh. He had used her name on the steps of Cavendish House, and the world had not ended. In fact, it had felt, more than anything he had done recently, like something true. She came into the room, but did not sit. She stood near the small table by the door with her hands folded in front of her. The gesture he recognized as her default composure, the thing she did when she was deciding how much to allow into the open. "I went to the archive," he said. There was no point in a preamble. She was not a woman who benefited from preambles. "The family records, the 1809 Wiltshire correspondence." He paused. "I read everything." Something moved through her face. Not surprise she had expected this or something like it, he thought. Something more complicated than surprise. A held breath released. "I see," she said quietly. "I need you to understand," he said, "that I did not know. I want to be clear about that, not as an excuse, but as a fact. I did not know what my grandfather did. I did not know what my father chose not to undo. I have spent my entire tenure as Duke managing this estate and this name without any knowledge of what is in that second drawer." He paused. "I am not asking you to absolve anyone. I am simply telling you the truth because I think you have been owed rather a lot of it." Vivienne looked at him for a long moment. Her expression was doing something complicated, something he could see the edges of but not the center. "Your father wrote that you were not your grandfather," she said. Her voice was very quiet. He stared at her. "Your father wrote." "He kept honest letters," she said. "Addressed to no one, he left them for me to find." She paused. "He wrote about your family, about the documents, about what they meant and what they cost and what he did not know how to do with them." Another pause, barely perceptible. "He also wrote that the current Duke was not his grandfather, that the wrong done was real, but the man who would answer for it had not been the one to do it." She held his gaze. He thought that mattered. James stood very still in the small, flower-scented room, with the rain beginning to streak the window behind him, looking at this woman whose grandfather had died believing a lie, whose father had spent his life carrying a truth too complicated to use, who had come to London to see something for herself and had apparently, in the course of 3 weeks of careful, guarded, deliberate proximity, begun to see it. "What did you come to see?" he said. "When you came to London, what were you looking for?" She was quiet for a moment, not the silence of evasion, the silence of someone arriving honestly at an honest answer. "I wanted to know," she said, "whether the name my father had been careful about deserved his carefulness." A pause. "Whether you were the kind of man whose family's wrongs should be laid at his door, or whether you were something else." She looked at him directly. "My father thought you might be something else. I wanted to find out if he was right." "And," James said. She looked at him for a long, still moment. And then the front door opened somewhere in the house, and Mrs. Hartley's voice came clearly down the hall, announcing that dinner was nearly ready. And the moment, that particular, precarious, extraordinarily important moment, cracked cleanly down the middle and fell apart. Vivienne looked away. The composure returned, settling back over her face like a curtain drawn quietly across a window. "You should go," she said. "It is nearly dinner." "Vivienne." "Please," she said, quietly but with a firmness that was not anger. I need some time to think. There is a great deal to think about." He looked at her. He wanted to say several things, none of which felt adequate to the weight of the last 10 minutes, and all of which seemed likely to do more harm than good if said now, in this small room, with Mrs. Hartley's voice still carrying from the hall and the rain coming harder against the window. "All right," he said. He picked up his hat from the side table. He crossed to the door where she was standing. He stopped. He was close enough to see the slight tension in her jaw, the thing she did. He had noticed over weeks of watching her more carefully than he had ever watched anyone, when she was holding something at considerable effort. "I am not going anywhere," he said, very quietly. "Take whatever time you need." He left. He was 3 streets away, walking through the rain without particularly noticing it, when his footman caught up to him, slightly breathless with his umbrella. "Your Grace, the carriage is just behind, if you—" "Thank you, Peters," James said, taking the umbrella without breaking stride. "I think I'll walk." Peters, who had been in James's employ for 6 years, and had developed a reliable instinct for when walking was not actually about the walking, fell back without further comment. James walked. He walked for a long time, through streets that were growing quiet as the rain thickened and the evening drew in, and he thought about a folder in a cabinet in his own archive, and a wooden box beneath a dead man's desk in Hampshire, and 2 parallel histories that had been running alongside each other, separated by a wall of deliberate silence, for 60 years. He thought about what it meant to inherit a name. Not the title, not the estate, not the money, but the name itself, with everything it had been used to do by men who had held it before him and made choices he would not have made and could not now unmake. He thought about what his father had said to his mother before the wedding, "You should know what you are marrying into," and had then not undone it. He thought about what it meant to be not his grandfather, whether it was enough, whether not doing a thing was a form of character or simply an absence of opportunity. He was still thinking about it when he arrived home, handed his wet coat to Hendricks, went to his study, sat down at his desk and wrote a letter. Not to Vivienne. Not yet. The letter to Vivienne required things he had not yet worked out how to say, and he had learned from watching her that it was better to mean what you said than to say it before you meant it properly. The letter was to his solicitor. It concerned the Wiltshire property records, the 1809 contracts, and the question of what, if anything, could still be done. He did not know if anything could. 60 years was a long time. The estate was long since sold and resold and altered beyond recognition. The money was spent, invested, dispersed into the ordinary flow of a family's decades. Vivienne's grandfather was dead. Her father was dead. But something could be done. He was certain of that. It might be inadequate. It might be too late to matter in any practical sense. It might be, in the end, nothing more than a gesture, and gestures were fragile, easily dismissed, not the same as justice. But his family had taken something from hers, and he was not his grandfather. He sealed the letter and left it on the hall table for the morning post. Then he went to bed and did not sleep well and was at his desk again by 6. He sent a note to Vivienne's cousin's house the following morning. Brief, careful, without pressure. He said that he hoped she was well, that he was thinking of her, that he would be at the Pemberton Gallery on Thursday afternoon if she wished to speak further, and that if she did not, he would understand. He received no reply. He went to the gallery on Thursday anyway. She was not there. He returned home and found Peters waiting with a note that had arrived an hour after he had left. He opened it. "I have gone to Hampshire for a few days. I need to think somewhere quiet. I am sorry not to have told you before you went. V.M. He read it twice. Then he folded it and put it in his coat pocket and stood in his front hall for a moment, thinking. Hampshire. He thought about a woman walking through fields she had grown up in a house full of her father's books and her father's honest letters, and the accumulated quiet of a life that had been disrupted and then lost. He thought about what she needed to think about, and whether thinking would resolve it or simply make the weight of it more precisely felt. He thought about what she had not said in the note, that she needed time, that she wasn't ready, that the distance between what she felt and what she could afford to feel was still too wide to cross from a sitting room in Mayfair. He was fairly certain, standing in his hall with her note in his pocket, that she would not come back to London. Not because she wanted to disappear, because she didn't know, yet, whether coming back was something she was allowed to want. He went upstairs and rang for his valet. "Pack for a few days," he said. "We're going to the country." His valet, a man of considerable experience and very few questions, said, "Yes, Your Grace," and went a pack. He did not take the ducal carriage. This was a decision he made deliberately, standing in the mews behind Cavendish House, while his valet loaded a single bag into a plain traveling chaise that belonged, technically, to the estate but carried none of its markings. Hendricks had raised an eyebrow at this. James had not explained. The explanation would have required him to articulate something he had not yet put into words, that arriving at Vivienne Marsh's door in the full regalia of the Duke of Ashford was precisely the wrong thing to do, and that he understood this in the same instinctive, wordless way he understood when a room had gone wrong without being able to say immediately what had changed in it. He left Peters behind as well, and his secretary, and the small retinue of administrative habit that usually accompanied him when he traveled. He took his valet, a driver in the bag. It was the most unencumbered he had felt in years. Hampshire in late spring was the kind of landscape that made a person understand why people wrote poetry, not because it was dramatic, not because it imposed itself on the eye with the grand ambition of the Scottish Highlands or the Derbyshire Peaks, but because it was quietly, persistently, entirely itself. The fields rolled in long, unhurried undulations. The hedgerows were thick and old. The light fell sideways through the trees in the late afternoon, in a way that made everything look simultaneously present and slightly remembered. James watched it through the carriage window and thought about Vivienne growing up in this, about what a person became when this was what they measured things against, the economy of it, the particular kind of intelligence that came from stillness. He had her father's address from the note. She had mentioned it without thinking, he believed, or perhaps with the unconscious intention of making herself findable. He chose not to examine the question too closely. The house was smaller than he had imagined, though he was not certain why he had imagined it larger. A stone cottage set back from a narrow lane, with a garden that had been carefully tended, and was now in the early stages of returning to its own preferences. The roses going slightly wild along the east wall, the path between the flower beds softening at its edges. A house that had been loved and was now being managed from a distance, maintained but not inhabited. He told the driver to wait at the lane. He walked up the path alone. She answered the door herself. This surprised him slightly, though it should not have. There were no servants in evidence, no smoke from the kitchen chimney that would indicate a housekeeper in residence. She had come here alone, or nearly so. He registered this without comment. She was wearing a plain gray dress and her hair was down, or rather up but loosely, in the way of a person who has put it up without particular attention, because putting it up is a habit rather than a performance. She had a book in her hand, her finger marking the page. Her feet, he noticed, were in very plain house slippers that she would not, under any circumstances, have been wearing in London. She looked at him. He looked at her. A silence elapsed that contained a remarkable number of things. "You followed me," she said. It was not an accusation. It was said with the same even tone she brought to most observations, a statement of fact being offered for mutual acknowledgement. "I did," he said. "I said I needed time to think." "You did," he said, "and I waited several days." Something moved in her expression, not quite amusement, not quite exasperation, but something that contained elements of both, moving through her composure the way light moves through water. "Several days," she repeated. "Four," he said, "which I will point out is considerably more than I wanted to wait." She looked at him for a long moment. Then she stepped back from the door and held it open. He went inside. The house smelled of books and old wood and something faintly herbal that might have been her mother's garden, dried and kept. It was warm inside despite its size. The afternoon light came through the south-facing windows with generous abundance, and the rooms, though modest, had the quality of spaces that had been thought about rather than simply furnished. Books everywhere, as he had expected. A desk in the front room with a clarity of organization that reminded him of her. Everything in its place, not from tidiness for its own sake, but from the habit of a person who knew where things were because they used them. He did not sit. She did not offer him a chair immediately, and he had the sense that the conversation needed to find its own shape before it could be conducted from armchairs. She set her book on the desk. She turned to face him with her hands at her sides rather than folded in front of her, which he had learned was a different register, less armored, though not deliberately so. Simply different. "How did you know where to come?" she said. "You mentioned the lane in a letter to the Countess 3 weeks ago," he said. "She told me when I asked. She also told me to be careful, which I intend to take seriously." Vivienne's expression did something complicated at the mention of the Countess. She should not have. "She said, specifically, that you would tell her she should not have," James said, "and that I should tell you she did it anyway, and she is entirely unrepentant." A breath of something that was almost a laugh escaped her. It lasted less than a second. Then her face composed itself again, and she looked at him with the directness she had been turning on him for weeks, that particular quality of attention that felt, every time, like being read accurately. "Why did you come, James?" she said. It was the first time she had used his name. He registered it the way he had registered the moment on the Whitmore Salon steps, as something small and significant, a door opening a precise inch and no further, not yet. "Because I needed you to know several things," he said, and I could not wait until you decided to come back to tell you.
And if I had not been coming back?
He looked at her steadily. Then I would rather tell you here than not tell you at all.
She held his gaze. He could see the effort of her composure, not the falseness of it, not performance, but the genuine effort of a woman who had spent a great deal of her life making sure she did not want things she could not afford, and who was finding that effort increasingly difficult in the presence of a specific person. He knew this because he recognized it. He had been doing the same thing for weeks in the opposite direction.
I spoke to my solicitor, he said. Before I came, I want you to understand that what I am about to say is not a gesture. It is not a grand gesture in lieu of something more important. It is a separate thing from the more important thing, and I want to keep them separate, because one of them is about law and history, and the other is about you and me, and I don't want them confused.
Vivienne looked at him carefully. Go on, she said.
The Wiltshire property is long gone, he said. What was done cannot be undone in any practical sense. The estate has changed hands 3 times. The original structure is altered beyond recognition. The money is dispersed irretrievably into 60 years of ordinary history.
I know that. He paused.
But there is a sum, a significant one, calculated by my solicitor from the original contract value and what a fair arrangement would have looked like in 1809.
It cannot restore what was taken, but it is accurate and it is owed, and it will be transferred to you as your grandfather's surviving heir as soon as the paperwork is complete.
Vivienne was very still.
You do not need to accept it, he said. I want to be clear about that as well. It is not contingent on anything. It is not an attempt to purchase goodwill or simplify a complicated situation. It is simply what is owed.
He paused.
My grandfather took something from yours. My father chose not to address it. I am not either of them, and I will not maintain their silence.
She was looking at him with an expression he had not seen before. Not the composure, not the reserve, not the careful, deliberate attention she usually brought to him.
Something beneath all of that. Something that looked, from the inside of it, like it might be painful. The way things are painful when they were not expected to be there, and the absence of them had been quietly managed for a very long time.
James, she said. Her voice was very quiet.
That is the first thing, he said. The legal thing, the separate thing, he paused. Can I tell you the other one?
She looked at him for a long moment, then she nodded, once small.
He took a breath.
I laughed at your name, he said. In a room full of men who thought the question of your suitability was a joke, I laughed, and I did not think about it for 3 seconds afterward because you were no one to me, a collection of unfavorable details assembled for comic effect.
He paused.
I am telling you this not because you don't know it, you were there, you heard it. You have known it every moment of every conversation we have had since, but because I want you to know that I know it.
That I have thought about it. That when I look at you, I am not unaware of what I did and what it cost, in whatever small way, to begin from there.
Vivienne said nothing. Her hands were still at her sides. Her expression had not changed, but something behind it had, something had shifted in the quality of her stillness. The way the temperature of a room shifts when a window is opened, too subtle to locate precisely but entirely impossible to miss.
I have been trying, he said, to become better acquainted with uncertainty, with not knowing, with sitting in the presence of a thing I cannot immediately resolve and finding, against my usual inclination, that the sitting is not unpleasant.
He paused.
You have been an extremely effective teacher in this regard, though I doubt you intended to be.
I did not intend very much of this, she said.
Her voice was still quiet, but it had a quality in it now that was different from before, less contained, not raw, but closer to the surface.
Oh, he said.
Neither did I, he looked at her directly. I came here without my carriage, without my name on the door, without any of the architecture that usually precedes me. I came because I wanted to stand in front of you as plainly as I know how and tell you that I am not my grandfather, and I am trying very hard not to be my father either, and I do not know yet what that makes me exactly, but I know that whatever it makes me, I would very much like you to be a part of determining." The room was very still. The late afternoon light came through the south window and lay in long golden bars across the floor between them, warm and ordinary, and entirely indifferent to the weight of the moment. Vivienne looked at him. He looked at her. He did not speak again because he had said what he had come to say, and he understood from weeks of watching her that the right thing now was to wait, not strategically, not with the calculated patience of a man managing a situation, but genuinely. To stand in the space he had made and let her come to it or not come to it, entirely on her own terms. She looked down at the floor between them, at the bars of light, then back up at him. "I burned the documents," she said. He stared at her. "When?" "The day I came here," she said. "The morning after," she stopped, began again. "I sat with them for a long time in my father's chair at his desk. I read them all the way through, which I had done before many times, and then I put them in the fireplace." She paused. "They were my father's to carry, not mine. He could not put them down. I could." A pause. "I did not burn them for you. I want to be clear about that." "I understand," he said. "I burned them because I realized that I had been carrying them as a reason," she said. "Not a reason to harm anyone, but a reason to not want things. A reason to keep a distance that felt like wisdom and was actually," she stopped again, looked at the window. "My father was a careful man. He was also a lonely one. He was careful about things that deserved care and careful about things that did not, and by the time he understood the difference, he was out of time." She turned back to James. "I did not want to make the same mistake." James said nothing. He did not move. He had the sense that the next several seconds were very important and that the worst thing he could do was interrupt them. Vivienne looked at him, directly, fully, without the reserve or the composure or the careful management of how much she was allowing into the open. Just looked at him, the way she had looked at him that very first evening in the Whitmore salon when he had said something about his father and the room with winter light, and she had said asterisk yes, that is exactly it, and the world had altered slightly, and neither of them had mentioned it. "You changed," she said quietly. "Not because I needed you to, not for any purpose. You simply changed. I watched it happen." She paused. "My father thought you might be something else. He was right." "I had good reason to change," James said. "I had considerable motivation." "That is not the same as doing it," she said. "No," he agreed, "it is not." Another silence, shorter this time. The golden light moved slightly as a cloud passed somewhere outside. "The compensation from your solicitor," she said. "I will accept it. Not for myself, I will give it to the county hospital in my grandfather's name. He would have found that fitting, I think. He was a practical man." "That is a better use of it than anything I would have thought of," James said. "Yes," she said, with the ghost of something that was very nearly a smile. "I thought so too." He took one step toward her. Not impulsive, deliberate, careful, the step of a man who had learned, slowly and at some cost, the difference between moving toward something and pursuing it. "Vivienne," he said, "I would very much like to stay for tea, if you are willing." She looked at him for a long moment, this man who had come without his carriage and his name and his architecture, who was standing in her father's house in the afternoon light looking at her with an expression that contained, she thought, more genuine uncertainty than she had seen from him in all the weeks of salons and gallery visits and carefully constructed proximity. She thought about her father's letter, about the word asterisk careful and what it cost and what it was worth, and when it stopped being wisdom and became simply fear with better posture. She thought about a room with winter light that she had said she would like to see someday, and the way he had said then you shall, as though it were the simplest thing in the world, as though wanting things and having them were not separated by an enormous and treacherous distance that she had been navigating alone for a very long time.
I will put the kettle on, she said. She turned toward the kitchen. She had taken 3 steps when she stopped and turned back and looked at him over her shoulder with an expression he had never seen on her before, open, warm, slightly undone, entirely and completely real. There are no servants, she said. You will have to carry the tray yourself. He smiled. It was not the disarming smile, not the social one, not the one that had opened 1,000 doors without effort. It was something considerably less polished and considerably more true. I believe, he said, that I can manage that. They had tea in the garden because the afternoon was warm and the roses along the east wall were beginning to open, and Vivienne said, without particular ceremony, that it seemed a waste to be inside. James carried the tray. He did not spill anything, which he considered a personal accomplishment. He sat in a garden chair that was slightly too small for him and drank tea from a cup with a small chip on the handle and said nothing for several minutes because the garden was quiet in the way of places that have been quiet for a long time and know how to share it. Vivienne sat across from him with her legs tucked beneath her in a way she certainly would not have done in London, her hands around her cup, looking at the roses with the expression she wore when she was thinking something she had not yet decided to say. "Tell me about the long gallery," she said eventually, "at Ashford Park, with the winter light." He looked at her. "You described it once," she said, without looking at him. "I have thought about it several times since." He told her. He told her about the gallery in more detail than he had offered in the Whitmore Salon, the length of it, the particular quality of the afternoon light in January, the portraits that lined the walls, including the ones he found difficult to look at, and the ones he found he could not look away from. He told her about his father pacing it on winter mornings, about sitting in it as a boy with a book, hidden behind the curtains at the far end, because it was the room in the house where no one thought to look for him. She listened with the full, unhurried attention she gave to everything, and when he finished, she was quiet for a moment. "I would like to see it," she said. The same words she had said at the Whitmore Salon, weeks ago, and then caught herself saying and looked away. This time she did not look away. "Then you shall," he said, as simply as before. She looked at him. Something in her expression shifted, settled, he thought. The way things settle when they have been uncertain for a long time and have finally found their ground. "I am not an easy person," she said. "I should tell you that now, if it is not already apparent. I am private and I am particular and I will disagree with you regularly, and I will not pretend that I don't." "I know," he said. "And I have strong opinions about how things ought to be done." "I had noticed. And I read a great deal, more than most people consider reasonable." "I have a library," he said, "that I have always felt deserved a better reader than it has generally received." She looked at him for a moment. Then she smiled fully, properly, without restraint, the smile he had seen once in the Whitmore Salon on that first evening when she was talking to her companion, the one that reached her eyes and changed everything about her face and lasted, this time, considerably longer than 3 seconds. It was, he thought, the most beautiful thing he had seen in a very long time. Possibly ever. He did not say this. Some things did not need saying immediately. Some things were better held for a moment, savored, understood, made certain of, before they were put into words. He would tell her soon. He was quite sure of that. For now he sat in the garden of her father's house in the Hampshire afternoon light, with a chipped teacup and an east wall of opening roses, and felt, for the first time in a very long time, entirely and precisely where he was supposed to be. 1 year later, the invitation to Lord Fenwick's autumn dinner had been sitting on James's desk for 3 days before Vivienne found it. She had not been snooping. She had been looking for a pen,
which she had set down somewhere in his study the previous afternoon while annotating a particularly dense passage in a history of land reform that James had procured for her from a bookseller in Edinburgh, and which had subsequently migrated to a location known only to itself. She had found it, eventually, beneath a letter from his steward. The Fenwick invitation had been visible underneath. She picked it up and read it. Then she set it back precisely where it had been and went to find her pen. James found her in the long gallery an hour later. This was not unusual. She spent a great deal of time in the long gallery, particularly in the late afternoon when the light was doing what she had once described to him, with characteristic precision, as its most interesting work. He had come to think of the gallery as partly hers now. She had rearranged two of the side tables, moved a chair 3 feet to the left to better catch the afternoon sun, and installed a small bookshelf near the south window that contained a rotating selection of whatever she was currently reading, which meant the room now smelled faintly of whatever was pressed between those pages. He found this, unreasonably, one of his favorite things about the house. She was standing near the far window with her hands behind her back, looking out over the winter park. The first frost had come the previous week, and the grounds were pale and still in the late afternoon light, the old trees casting long shadows across the grass. She turned when she heard him. "I saw the Fenwick invitation," she said. "I thought you might have," he said. "Are you going to tell me what you think?" "I think Lord Fenwick has not changed his habits," she said. "I think the dinner will be exactly like the last one he hosted in every detail that matters." "Probably," James agreed. "Are you coming?" She looked at him with the expression he had come to know as her thinking expression, not deliberating exactly, but allowing whatever she already knew to arrive at the surface in its own time. "Yes," she said, "I think I am." The dinner was held on a Thursday in the third week of November at Fenwick's townhouse in Berkeley Square. The rooms were warm, the wine was excellent, and Lord Fenwick presided over his table with the familiar satisfaction of a man who believed he had arranged the world to its best advantage. There were 8 of them at the table. Pembury was there, and 2 men James had known since university and their wives, and a young viscount whose name James kept forgetting, and Lord Fenwick himself, and James, and on his right, his wife, the Duchess of Ashford, who was wearing her mother's pearl at her throat, as she generally did, and who was engaged in a conversation with Pembury's wife about the county hospital in Hampshire that had recently received an anonymous endowment substantial enough to fund a new surgical wing, which was, the papers had reported, quite remarkable given the size of the county and the usual difficulties of rural philanthropic giving. James listened to this conversation with a particular quality of attention. The dinner proceeded, the courses came and went. The conversation moved, as it did at Fenwick's table, through property and politics, and the coming season and several topics James contributed to, and several he did not, because Vivienne was beside him and he had found, in the year since the Hampshire Garden, that conversations he would previously have found tolerable at best were now actively enjoyable simply by virtue of being able to glance to his right and find her there listening with her whole face, offering an opinion when she had one, which was frequently, and being entirely right about it, which was more frequently than he had initially anticipated and had since come to rely on. The dessert course arrived. Fenwick refilled glasses with the generous authority of a host who considers the evening a success and wishes to extend it. And then Fenwick, who could not resist the thing he did best, leaned back in his chair with the expression of a man holding a card. "I have been thinking," he said, addressing the table generally, "about young Ashbourne's boy. He comes of age next spring. Someone ought to begin thinking about suitable matches." This produced the usual mild interest of people who did not have strong feelings on the subject,
but were willing to be entertained by it.
The Hartley girl, someone offered.
Spoken for, said someone else.
What about, Fenwick named a young woman James did not recognize.
Too young, said Pemberry's wife firmly.
Fenwick smiled. He named another, then another. Each name was assessed and found wanting for various reasons, in the pleasant, unhurried way of people who are enjoying the process more than they care about the outcome.
James said nothing. He was watching Vivienne, who was listening to this familiar ritual with an expression of composed attention that he recognized, the particular quality of her listening when she found something privately, quietly amusing and had no intention of sharing why.
He glanced at her.
She glanced at him.
1 second. No more. But it contained, in the compressed and wordless language they had developed over a year of mornings and long evenings and conversations that went longer than either of them intended, an entire exchange, the recognition of where they were and how they had come to be here, the particular absurdity and particular rightness of sitting at this table in this room that had once been the location of a joke told at her expense, now entirely recontextualized by her presence in it.
She looked away, back to Fenwick. Her expression did not change.
James looked back at the table.
And then Fenwick, either from genuine obliviousness or a flair for occasion that James had not previously credited him with, said,
"There's a Cumberland girl, Harwick's niece, I think, who is said to be."
He was cut off by a sound. Not a loud sound, not a dramatic one, simply laughter.
Not from James. From Pemberry's wife, at something Vivienne had murmured to her, too quietly for the rest of the table to hear.
Pemberry's wife laughed with genuine delight and covered her mouth, and looked at Vivienne with an expression of conspiratorial warmth, and Vivienne smiled back, that full, unguarded smile, the one that reached her eyes and transformed her entirely, and the sound of it moved through the room the way warmth moves through a cold space, altering the temperature of everything it touched.
Fenwick paused.
He looked down the table toward Vivienne.
His expression did something complicated. The expression of a man who is reassessing a series of prior assumptions and finding the arithmetic less comfortable than it had previously appeared.
James watched this happen with a great deal of private satisfaction.
He picked up his wine glass. He turned to his wife.
"Miss Harwick," he said very quietly for her ears only, apparently well-read.
Vivienne turned to him. Her eyes were bright.
"Is she," she said, in the same register.
"So I'm told."
"And what do they make of that at this table?"
He looked at her for a moment, at this woman who had stood on the other side of a wall and heard her name turned into a punchline, and had walked away from it with her gloves adjusted and her head straight, and a decision already formed, who had carried her father's truth and her grandfather's wound, and an honest letter addressed to no one across a season of careful, guarded proximity, who had burned the documents in her father's fireplace on a Hampshire morning because she had decided, with the quiet finality she brought to most decisions, that the past deserved its rest, who had told him she was not an easy person as a warning, and had been entirely right, and whom he had found to be the most interesting, most honest, most entirely herself person he had ever sat across a table from, in a career of sitting across tables from people, who was, at this moment, wearing her mother's pearl and a small, private smile, and looking at him with eyes that contained, as they always did, the particular quality of someone who saw things accurately and was not afraid of what they saw.
"I believe," James said, "that they are beginning to revise their opinions."
Vivienne looked at him for a moment. Then she looked back at the table at Fenwick, still slightly recalibrated, and Pemberry, who was watching them both with the expression of a man who had witnessed something he had seen coming for considerably longer than either party involved, and the rest of the assembled guests, who were variously aware that something had shifted in the atmosphere without being quite able to say what.
"Good," she said simply.
She turned back to Pemberry's wife, who was waiting to resume their conversation with the patience of a woman who had correctly identified what was worth waiting for. James set down his wine glass. He looked at the table around him, at this room, this dinner, these assembled people who had once laughed at a name and were now sitting in the considerable and entirely unself-conscious presence of the woman who bore it. He thought about standing on the other side of a wall, laughing at something he did not understand. He thought about laughter that stops. And then he thought about everything that had happened in the silence after it, the long and complicated and entirely necessary silence, and he found that the silence, on reflection, had been the best part. Outside, the November evening pressed against the windows of Berkeley Square, cold and dark and entirely indifferent. Inside, the candles burned steadily down, and the wine was poured again, and the conversation turned, as it always did, toward everything and nothing. And at the far end of the table, barely audible beneath the ordinary music of the room, the Duchess of Ashford said something that made Pemberry's wife laugh again. And the sound of it carried. Thank you for listening to the story all the way to the end. Please tell us which city you're watching from and what the story made you feel. Don't forget to subscribe so you won't miss new stories.